What's going on, movie fans? I'm John.
And I'm Rossi, and this is Movie Lovers Unite, the podcast where your favorite films come to life.
Every week, we deep dive into the movies you love, from cult classics and guilty pleasures to the latest in theaters and streaming.
We're talking reviews, reactions, heated debates, top five lists, and interviews with filmmakers, actors, and fellow fans.
Whether you're a casual viewer or a hardcore cinephile,
we've got something for you, with laughs, hot takes, and plenty of popcorn-worthy moments.
New episodes drop every week on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your fix.
So grab your snacks, press play, and join the conversation, because the movie talk is just getting started.
Welcome to Zombie Strange, the podcast where we watch all the zombie movies in order. This episode, the year is 1962, and we are watching a film in the actual Criterion Collection, Carnival of Souls.
And that's not even a joke.
No, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them, zombies or something?
Zombie.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, there's, Mr. Bill is...
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
He's a zombie.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
What is wrong? What is wrong? Well,
yeah, that wasn't a joke. This movie is in the Criterion Collection. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
I'm Brad.
Wow. So this was a good movie. Like,
yeah, what did we just watch, you guys? Am I in the right podcast?
I wasn't expecting a movie to like be really trippy and blow my brain for another decade or so. So I was very excited about this movie. So yeah, the movie we're talking about is Carnival of Souls from 1962. Brad's going to tell us all about the release, cast, and crew, but I will mention this is an independent film in the truest sense of the word, in all the ways that we love independent films. So we'll get into the details as we go in. But before we do, anybody doing or watching anything zombie-related? Andy, you got anything going on?
Not really. You know, I've been buried in reading up on the 60s in preparation for our special episode about what is scary about the 1960s.
That's great. And I've been... Buried would be a generous word. I did read Slouching Towards Bethlehem by Joan Didion, which I've never read before. It is
fantastic.
It's a great book. And she talks about sort of the end of the 1960s, the end of hippiedom and Haight-Ashbury in a very interesting way because she's not a boomer. Anyway, we'll talk about it during the 1960s episode that we are doing very soon. So keep an eye out for that. How about you, Brad? Are you doing anything even not zombie related? What are you watching or doing recently?
Nothing zombie, just making my way through the old Universal horror movies for fun.
Oh, that's good. Can't argue with that. So
yeah, that's time well spent.
So far, my favorite's The Invisible Man.
Nice. All right. So Andy, we're not going to do trigger warnings for this movie, but I think we might want to do another kind of warning here.
Yeah, for sure. So this is a big spoiler warning for this movie. This is a movie you should go watch. So you should stop this podcast right now and go watch this movie. Let it delight and surprise and amaze you. But it does have a big sort of twist ending. And we are going to spoil the heck out of it probably right away in our discussion.
Yes.
So pause, go watch the movie, then come back. Because if you don't, you truly will be missing out on something special in this movie.
Fair enough. And I think all three of us would agree that this movie is worth watching. We'll spoil the end of the podcast and say, I think we're all going to give this a thumbs up for general audience watch for sure.
Yes.
So, all right, Brad, we'll take us into the cast and crew. Tell us what you got.
Carnival of Souls premiered on September 26, 1962. Other films opening this week were The Longest Day with John Wayne, Robert Mitchum, and Henry Fonda, and G-Go, directed by Gene Kelly and starring Jackie Gleason. Kirk Harvey directed Carnival of Souls. He worked for Centron Corporation, a production company based in Lawrence, Kansas, that produced industrial and educational films. Harvey was a producer and director for Centron, and his first industrial film was in 1950 and called Buying Food. He produced nearly 50 shorts for Centron with titles like Pork, The Meal with a Squeal, None for the Road, Operation Grass Killer, and Psychological Differences Between the Sexes.
Yeah, I noticed, I looked at his credits after I watched the movie, and I'm like, he directed a lot of commercials and short, like, educational films, basically.
Three of his shorts were even featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Huh.
Harvey was inspired to make a feature film after Robert Altman, another industrial film director from nearby Kansas City, made a low-budget film called The Delinquents, which was sold to United Artists for a profit. I'll post a link in the show notes to one of Altman's early educational films called Modern Football from 1951. Harvey gathered a group of colleagues to help make Carnival of Souls. Harvey asked his friend John Clifford, who was a staff writer at Centron, to help write the screenplay. Harvey had recently seen the abandoned Salt Air Pavilion on the shores of the Great Salt Lake and envisioned a horror movie ending there. His goal was a film with the look of Bergman and the feel of Cocteau. Huh.
I think he kind of succeeded, though I have some comments on the look when we get there.
And John, you and I probably know Robert Altman from a particularly special show that was aired.
Yeah.
He directed a bunch of episodes of Bonanza.
Yes, he did, Robert Altman. Not that that's the subject of this podcast, but because we listened to a podcast about Bonanza, we're not going down this rabbit hole. We know that Robert Altman directed episodes of Bonanza.
A Carnival of Souls had a $30,000 budget and was shot in 3 weeks with locations in both Utah and Kansas. The cinematographer, Maurice Prather, and the composer, Gene Moore, were both veterans of the Kansas industrial and educational film scene. Harvey also hired Robert Altman's assistant director, Reza Badayi. Badayi was the AD on Altman's The Delinquents. He went on to direct more than 400 episodes of television, shows like Get Smart, Mission Impossible, The $6 Million Man, The Rockford Files, The Incredible Hulk, Falcon Crest, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Baywatch, and Sliders.
Whoa.
You had me at The Rockford
That's
Files.
That's crazy.
The hidden gem of the 70s.
In addition, he also created two of the most famous television title sequences of all time, Hawaii Five-O and The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Oh, wow. I can picture both of those when you say that.
That's the sign of a good title sequence, if you remember it. And he was the stepfather to Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Huh.
Oh.
Now, the cast, Candace Hilligoss plays Mary Henry. She studied acting in New York, but has only 7 acting credits. In 1964, she was in The Curse of the Living Corpse, and despite its title, it is not a zombie film.
That's unfortunate.
She was in an episode of Quincy MD in 1981, and in 2001, she was featured in the documentary Talk Fast, which follows a week in the life of 5 screenwriters. Sidney Berger plays John Linden. This is one of his 3 film roles. His last credit was a cameo as a cop in the 1998 film Carnival of Souls. More about that in a second. Berger was the director for the University of Houston School of Theater and Dance from 1969 to 2007.
Wow.
And when you read the school's obituary for him, you can tell he was very well respected and liked.
Nice.
And the last cast member I'll talk about is The Man. And he's uncredited in the film, but in the Criterion credit list, the scary man who follows Mary around was played by the director, Herc Harvey.
Huh.
Yes.
The rest of the cast were regulars in the film. Films made by Centron and have few credits. One of the main set pieces in the film is the abandoned Salt Air Resort on the Great Salt Lake. There were 3 Salt Airs. The one seen in this film is the second. The first was built in 1893 by the Mormon Church and was a great success. People flocked to float on the salt water, dance on the world's largest dance floor, and ride the amusement park rides. It reached its peak success in the early 1920s. It burned in 1925.
Ah, whoa.
The second Salt Air was built at the same spot. This version had several challenges and never had the same success. The Great Depression, the increasing popularity of film, and the advent of cars all reduced attendance. Then in 1933, the lake waters receded and the resort was no longer on the lake shore. Salt Air closed in 1958, just 4 years before the release of Carnival of Souls. It was destroyed by a fire in 1970.
So we've seen an artifact in this film that you cannot see.
Amazing.
Anymore.
Correct. There is a new one there that was built in 1982 and it's still active. But of course, it had its own problems. A few years after being built, the lake returned and flooded parts of it under 5 feet of water.
Sorry, that's not funny. Also, when you were telling the history of these buildings that kept burning down, I just couldn't stop thinking that one burned down, fell over, and then fell into the swamp. So sorry.
In the show links, I'll put the Salt Air's website on there because they have some documentaries that tell the history of the place too.
Okay.
Carnival of Souls is very similar to the 1890 short story An Occurrence at Owl Creek by Ambrose Bierce. Have you guys heard of it?
I've read Ambrose Bierce stories.
I have, yes.
I don't want to say they have no plot, but they're just like a couple pages of atmosphere, and they're generally very short. Is this your recollection, Andy?
Yes. This is also similar to a short story by Richard Matheson, who we talked up a ton last week, called Death Ship.
Yes.
Well, like Carnival, it starts with a seemingly near-death experience. This was made into a 1962 short film by French director Robert Enrico. It won Best Short at the 1962 Cannes Film Festival and the 1963 Oscar for Best Live Action Short. In 1964, the short was an episode of the fifth season of The Twilight Zone. So you can kind of get a sense, for those who haven't seen the film, we're talking about what kind of film it is.
Death Ship was also used as a Twilight Zone episode, although the episode screenplay butchered the sublime nature of the story, in my opinion.
Yeah, we're going to spoil this just as soon as Brad's done, probably.
Kirk Harvey and the film's investors didn't make any money on the film. Because of the lack of sex and violence, Harvey had trouble finding a distributor.
Yeah.
Only one would take on the film. When Harvey called the distributor to get a report on how the film was doing, the distributor sent him a check, which then bounced. The distributor disappeared to Europe, and to make matters worse, he sold 80 bootleg copies of the film to TV stations, even though only Harvey had the television rights.
Oh, wow.
This led to the film being shown a lot during the 60s and was how most people found the film. The film began to find appreciation in 1989 when it was shown in art houses for Halloween.
You know, Brad had sent us, and we'll put in the show notes, an interview, a reunion, and the director, they're showing it in an art house theater, and he said, you know, that's where it should have been shown in the first place. And I can't help but agree, this movie feels really out of place with the other movies we've been watching.
That this didn't launch at least the Mary actor's career into something great is amazing to me.
Yeah.
No, but what happened was it was sort of forgotten until 1989. It was started to be shown in art houses. It became popular. The cast and crew had a reunion. Roger Ebert gave it a review in 1989, and he gave it 3 out of 4 stars. And he noted that the lurching undead reminded him of Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, interesting.
In 2019, Mike Patton, former lead singer of Faith No More and Jean-Claude Vanier, released the album Corpse Flower.
Whoa.
One of the songs, A Schoolgirl's Day, had a video that was composed entirely of footage from Carnival of Souls. The soundtrack itself was released in 2023 under the banner Rob Zombie Presents, and you can stream it now.
Is this all original music?
Yes.
Yeah,
it is. That's amazing. Wow.
After the cast and crew had a reunion in 1989, Candace Hilligoss started working on a script for a sequel. Reza Badii was interested in the script, but by 1998, an outside producer got the rights to make a movie based on Carnival of Souls. Not a remake and not a continuation, but he just used the title. Hilligoss was offered a part, but since they didn't use her script that featured her original character, she passed. And unsurprisingly, it was not very well received.
Yeah, that isn't a surprise. That was probably
1998 might be the worst time to do a remake of a classic horror film, right?
Yeah.
That is all I have, guys.
That is enough. So I'm fascinated to hear that this is all original music, because that just makes it even better. Which is a shocking admission. But I want to, can we talk about the movie for a second,
please,
before we jump into it? Because what I wanted to say, and I'm gonna hammer this point until, if everybody's not already sick of it, I'm gonna keep going. This is, again, regional independent cinema. The people who made it are from Kansas. They're from Lawrence, Kansas. They have no intention of making a Hollywood movie. They made a movie set in Kansas about Kansas. Well, it was about Utah. But, and that's just like Night of the Living Dead. So I think if there's any sort of there's a lot of precursors in this movie to Night of the Living Dead, which we'll get to. But I think I just want to keep hammering that one, is that this is independent cinema, and that's why we love it, and that's why we love Night of the Living Dead. Not that Hollywood movies are bad. You know, I walked with the Zombies, a Hollywood movie, and it's brilliant, right? But this the independent spirit in horror movies in particular has something special, I think. Am I crazy talking?
That's totally right.
Okay, so before we get into it, after my soapbox speech about independent cinema, historical context, Andy.
Yeah, so I don't have much for you this time. So we're still in 1962. We've been here for a couple episodes now. And I think I'm just going to refer listeners to the last couple of episodes to listen to the historical context there, because not a lot has changed. And also, John and I are prepping a full episode, a bonus episode on the 1960s and what was scary about the 1960s. So yeah. I don't have anything new to add here that I haven't said in past couple episodes. So back to you, John.
All right. Well, I just want to get started with the movie. We are going to spoil the heck out of it, but maybe not right out of the gate. But we start, again, in media res, there is a drag race ongoing. There's three girls in a car, and they drag race some boys in a car. It does not go well, and the girl's car goes careening off a wooden bridge and into a river, where it is lost. And then we get these crazy, well, I think the credits are just before this, but the credits are crazy.
Well,
Can we talk about that?
Roll right after the girl's car goes off the bridge.
Okay. All right. So I was right about that. So they're like slanted and angled and bespoke. They are not regular credits. And I think they're the most sort of inspiring credits we've seen. And they fit so well at the film because they're designed to unsettle you. And
agreed.
It's so clear.
I have a quick comment about this. So I watched this on YouTube. And
yeah, me too.
I just want to say I had the subtitles on for a while, and I don't know what's going on, guys. Maybe this is an AI thing, but the subtitles were disastrously wrong. Did you
notice turned
this?
Them off.
Yeah.
They were so bad.
They
that's not what they're saying.
Yeah. They are like simply inaccurate representations of what's being said in the film. I can't really explain it. So I don't know if
that was
just
bizarre.
YouTube turned it over to AI and AI did a terrible job of it, but, turn the subtitles off on this one and just enjoy the, I don't know. It was weird. No,
I watched it on HBO without subtitles, but I'm going to guess that maybe the HBO version had proper subtitles.
Okay.
It could be, but I would say like, I know that subtitles are a thing and I've stopped trying to fight it, but I would say a big element to this film is silence,
yes,
or if not silence, silence with eerie music in the background. And I'm glad I turned them off, because the last thing I would like to see is our main character, Mary, wandering through an episode that she has during this movie, and it says eerie music playing along the bottom. So, you know, I think it could interfere with your experience in the film.
Yes, absolutely. You know?
And right off the bat, like there are downsides to independent cinema, right? So right off the bat, you know, as soon as the credits roll, we've got rescuers on the bridge trying to find the car. They're dredging the lake for the car, which is less dramatic than it is in modern movies. Basically, they're throwing a giant hook out into the water and seeing if it catches on anything. It's like they're fishing, but like for the biggest fish ever. But the ADR, additional dialogue recording, in this sequence in particular, is terrible. And I think that just speaks to it's hard to film near moving water without that sound dominating. And so they had to do ADR, and it's not great.
I'm sure you're thinking of Teenage Zombies, where they, at every scene near the beach, they simply had to dub the audio because they couldn't edit out the sound of the surf. But yes.
Yeah. But what is fascinating about this is we continue, like we have these shots of flowing water under the credits, and they're all sort of unsettling and bizarre and just different than things we've seen in the past.
Yes.
And there's talk of there's talk on the bridge as they're looking, oh, it's been 3 hours. There's no way anybody's alive in there, et cetera, et cetera. And then out walks one of the girls. Do you want to describe this for us, Andy?
Yeah. So a bedraggled, mud-covered woman crawls out of the lake onto the bank. This is Mary, who is going to be our protagonist for the rest of the film, the seeming sole survivor of this car wreck.
Right.
And can I just say, so the, I don't know what the film term for it is, but whoever is deciding what camera angles are used is a genius in this movie, or at least
the director of photography,
so far beyond anything else we've seen in this podcast. There is no shot that isn't taken from an unusual, interesting angle.
And the film is filled with lots of strange transitions and other things sort of constantly that we haven't seen either. Like, for example, we're about to get to it. Like, so the survivor, Mary, she crawls out. She survives. We see her. She sort of comes back to the lake, comes back to the river to see what happens. Our first cool, quote unquote, weird transition. She puts the key in the car to turn the ignition after looking longingly at the river. And it cuts to, and that the key the slot where the key goes in transitions to the to a control on an church organ, which Mary is now playing. And so this is the setup. Mary is playing an organ at what looks like an organ factory, and everybody there stops to listen to her because she's so good, and they're smiling. And she finishes playing, and she's gonna leave. Now, what's the setup here, Andy? Like she's got a job in a church, right?
Yeah. So she's taken a job at a church in Utah to be their organ player,
right?
And kind of key to her personality is that this is just a job to her. She's a professional. She plays the organ. So throughout this film, people seem to kind of ask more of her about her job playing the organ, like it's a sort of a special or a spiritual practice. But she insists that it's just a job. She's just here to play the organ. She doesn't want to interact with the church people. She's just here to do her job, right?
Yeah, and in fact, she gets this lecture early on that sort of nails down the point that they're trying to make about her job.
Mary, it takes more than intellect to be a musician. Put your soul into it a little.
And that's it, and that's brief, but I think that makes the point, like, that's very specifically said, put your soul into it, yeah. Right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, hey, guys, I got to share. I have been on the committee to replace an old giant church organ that is dying.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
It was less cool than this movie, I will say, the experience of replacing the organ. It involved a lot more getting quotes from like swarthy craftsmen and and occasionally sending someone to drive out to like someone seven states away to evaluate their church organ that was for sale.
So, did you check out the organ maker in Lawrence, Kansas?
So it is entirely possible. We like our organist did several across the country trips to like test out organs, basically.
Yeah, it's like buying a house in Oregon. Like, it's such a big thing.
Like, it literally is about as much as it would cost to purchase a house, yes.
Yeah, I imagine. Wow.
So the organ maker in Lawrence, Kansas is Reuter, R-E-U-T-E-R. Okay. Does that name ring a bell?
It doesn't, no.
Like Reuter News?
Correct.
Oh.
It's been around since 1919.
Oh, really?
Huh. All right. So Mary just leaves. She's like, I'm not taking anything. I don't have any friends. There's nothing for me here. She hops in the car and goes. This is, by the way, a Chevy Impala for those keeping score at home.
Yes, I was going to ask about the cars. Yes.
There's a lot of cars in this movie, but yeah.
I think she specifically says that she's never coming back to this place.
So. And she's never coming back. But she has her first, what we'll call episodes. And this is genuinely creepy. So she's driving at night. She's driving from Kansas to Utah. It's nighttime. And throughout this whole film, over the credits, and now as she's driving, we hear this creaky, creepy organ music that is unlike anything I've ever heard before. Like, at one point, she plays the organ, and she plays it beautifully, but all of the music here is organ music, but it's dissonant, it's strange, it's like nothing you would hear in a church. Can you add any mustard to that, Andy? I don't even know what to say about it other than it's totally engaging.
Not really, except that it's fully unique. It's I can't think of, I mean, this is a movie where the soundtrack is a huge part of the experience. And you, yeah.
And I almost want to get the soundtrack, but I'm worried that it would like often I will listen to instrumental music while I'm working or something to help create focus. I think this would do the opposite. You know.
Yeah, well, like you say, it's dissonant, right? It's not satisfying music to listen to.
No, it's unsettling.
It'd be great to play on Halloween as trick-or-treaters come up.
Yes, actually, that would be great. That's a good idea. So as she's driving, though, bizarre things happen. So this is really brilliantly shot, and I want to take special note of it because, again, we haven't seen anything like this, and this seems incredibly modern to me.
Yes.
So at one point, she's driving. There's light on her face. She becomes paranoid. I think she sees the structure in the distance, which is the pavilion that's going to be central to the movie, which we're about to have a gas station attendant tell us about it. But before he does, we see it. As she's driving, she becomes very anxious and she starts looking around. And And it's hard to describe this shot, but we are seeing her through the driver's side window, not through the front window. And there's a reflection, her own reflection, on the passenger window behind her. And as this is happening, what happens is the face of a like, looks like a zombie face or ghost face appears in the far window. Yes. She looks at it and screams. And then when she looks again, it's her own face again. But I, you know, this may have been happening in other movies, but this is the first time this would be like a modern, this would be something from an 80s or a 90s slasher movie, right? Yeah. This seems way early for this. So what did this do to you?
I'll just betray my ignorance of the art of filmmaking here, but this sort of scene would be trivially done with like CGI.
Yes.
But knowing that they did not have CGI, I want to know how they got her reflection in that window to look so good and so clear. It's really good.
It is really good. And I, you know, that's sort of the art of independent filmmaking. Like, what do you have to do to get exactly what you want there? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I just go on a brief tangent here. One of the disappointing things about CGI, I mean, it's great. I love it. I'm not going to tell you I hate all movies with CGI, but I just miss hearing the stories about crazy stuff people had to do to get exactly the shot they wanted.
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite stories is in the original Jurassic Park. Even though that movie featured CGI, there is a moment where the T-Rex is stalking the kids and there's a cup of water on the dash and it's just, there are these little ripples in it that keep showing up. And the way they had to do that is they had to take everything out from under the dash and they ran a guitar string under it because they needed as little as possible and somebody would pluck the guitar string in time. And that's what, you know, like stories like that are kind of what make, well, even though I guess it's a 30-year-old movie now, but that's what makes older movies fun in a way.
Yeah, for sure. Know? Like learning that, you know, someone had to lay in the mud for like 12 hours in freezing weather to get a particular shot, you know?
Yeah, well, that actually happens in this movie to Mary's character later. We'll get to it. But she, in this little documentary clip we watched, she talks about how she had to spend 8 hours in a car filled with water. So, yeah, we'll get to that. But so she has this freaky experience. She stops to get gas. And right at the end there, this is back when gas station attendants came out and filled up your car. And she's chatting with the attendant, and she asks him this question, and they have this conversation.
Have anything else, lady?
Could you tell me what that big structure is back a few miles by the lake?
Oh, you mean the old bathhouse? Yeah, that used to be a pretty ritzy place in the old days. Then the lake went down, and they made a dance hall out of it. Then they put those buildings up out there and made some sort of a carnival there for a while. That's years ago, though. Just stands out there now.
I see.
Can I call out? So, this is not our first movie that has featured an encounter at a gas station, a roadside gas station.
same thing.
I mean, I don't want to overstate this, but I think that we in modern society we have lost like sort of the centrality of the gas station experience as a common point of reference, because at the time these movies were being made, and I'm talking like starting in the 30s and 40s up obviously through the 60s at least, I mean, when you stopped at a gas station, you had a human encounter with the person at the gas station, whoever
that was.
Yeah. And I was born too late to ever have that. You know, I think by the time I was ever filling a car full of gas, we were in our modern era where you just pay at the pump and quickly at the cashier and then pump it yourself and go. But this is, I don't know, it's just interesting. We've probably seen 4 or 5 movies now that have featured a stop at a gas station. And this movie includes several of them.
Yes.
As a sort of like, as a whole scene unto itself.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I just to relate a silly story, when I was in Ireland maybe 8 years ago, we rented a car and we stopped to get gas and there was no place to pay at the pump. So I went inside and I said, I can't pay. How do I pay? He just goes, Americans, just pump it and then come back and pay when you're done. I was like, oh, okay. So she goes on from the gas station. There's another stylish transition where he says, you know, she says, where's the boarding house I'm supposed to be staying at? And he says, it's right over there. And he points and the camera pans and then to black, which then is relieved by a door opening inward on her room at the boarding house. Another, yes, just like one of those delightful transitions in this movie. So we meet her landlady, who does show up a couple of times. I'm just going to refer to her as the landlady.
Yeah, me too. I didn't catch her name either.
Oh, her name is Mrs. Thomas. There you go. As she's there, she's unpacking in her room, and what appears right outside her window?
Well, she hallucinates seeing this corpse again. I mean, in, why don't we pause
for a minute? Let's describe it.
It's kind of our zombie for the film. So
yes,
this is, I would say this would not look out of place in like a 1930s zombie movie. It's a pasty white corpse in a dark suit, the sort you might be buried in, I guess. And he's got
Dark circles.
Yeah, he's got dark circles around his eyes, which is, I guess, the kind of an old timey way of conveying this is a corpse, right?
Right. Now, we're going to have to discuss this as we go. I know that we're a zombie podcast, and this was on our list of zombie movies. He really feels more like a ghost to me.
Yes,
at this time. It feels like a ghost story that we're watching right now.
Yeah.
So she screams. That happens. And then we cut to her. She sleeps. She gets up. She goes to work at the church, right? And she meets her.
I can't overstate, by the way, how good the transitions from one scene to the next are in this film. Like, they are often jarring and always interesting, I will say.
Yes, and that's a lot of fun. Now, one thing that I noticed at this point, that the palette is really flat so far. And I thought for most of the movie, like, it was through lack of effort or desire. So what I mean by that is just there's no shadows. It's all light. It's just variations of light. There's no dark. However, later the movie the director brings in that sort of noirish high contrast really strongly. So I realized it's not that he didn't want to do it. He was saving it for the crazy ending. So
yep, exactly.
But again, so she goes, she meets her new boss who is a priest. They don't say what denomination. He looks like a Lutheran to me, but this is not my area of expertise.
Yeah, I think we call it, do Lutherans have priests or pastors?
Pastors.
Pastors, okay.
But he doesn't look like a Catholic priest. He looks like because Lutherans have the collar and everything, but it's different.
Yeah.
So, but we meet her, and here she says, you know, he's like, I've planned, you know, the ladies. Sorry, this is still the 1960s, so there's a lot of sexism here or stereotyping. The ladies have planned a big reception for you, and she's like, "Oh, can we skip it?"
As a regular church girl, I've heard this language as recently as like, you know, 2014. So
so she wants to skip the whole thing. She doesn't want to get to know anybody. She just wants to come to work, live her life, and sort of be left alone. But who does she see walking around the church while she's playing the organ?
It's our old friend, that corpse, that zombie, that ghost, whatever we're calling it.
Yes.
And he has entered the church.
And she sort of has another one of these fugues where she's sort of like an out-of-body experience. She has seen this man in the rooming house as well. And so she keeps seeing him in places, I think, is the point.
Yes.
But then she goes home. Like, she's not totally, she's unsettled by it. But she just keeps going. She goes home, and who does she meet? Our other main character, the charming, handsome, and incredibly
creepy
John Linden. He's Johnny. He's like, I think in the Ebert's review, he called him the original creepy nerd or something.
Yes.
Like,
oh my gosh.
He called it a definitive study of nerdy lust.
A study in nerdy lust.
This guy is so uncomfortable to watch on the film. Like, it's so bad.
And he's supposed to be.
Yes.
Yeah. And I also want to say, like, the acting, if we've given you the impression that you're watching like an A-list film, that's not the impression we're trying to give. It's not like the acting is A-list. It's that all the weird sort of clunky parts of this movie come together in a way that really works.
Yes.
Does that make any sense?
That's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah. And John, so it's not like Johnny's, though he did become the director of a drama department, like, it's not like he's a genius actor. There's some holes and cracks here, right? But
yeah.
But it all works. So, of course, Johnny just wants to... He's a lech, I put in my notes.
Yeah.
He's a boring lech and a jerk. And he just wants to like, get inside her room, get to know her. He's, as we used to say, on the make. And she doesn't want to have anything to do with him.
Yeah, she's shaken by his creepiness.
Yes. Yep. But she gets rid of him, goes to bed. My next note is, then she wakes up to an old-fashioned alarm clock. And my note is, I forgot how annoying old-fashioned wind-up or battery alarm clocks are. They're so loud. There's just this clanging sound, and the whole thing vibrates. When I was in college, I had a buddy who would wake up and turn off his alarm and go back to bed. And at one point, he put his alarm clock in a locked box on the other side of the room, so that he had to get up and unlock the box, otherwise he couldn't get out of bed to go to class. And I just, yeah, it was so crazy making first roommate. That was actually Brad, our mutual friend Matt. Hey Matt, owner of Underground Sounds, if you're listening to my podcast, I just told your story.
I don't remember the details. In a previous episode, I don't think it made it onto air, but I went down a rabbit hole of when alarm clocks were invented.
That's right.
When I learned that in Victorian London, if you needed to be woken up at a certain time, you would hire a guy with a big pole to walk down the street and bang on your window with his pole at a certain time. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. All right. That's a free historical tidbit that you weren't expecting from this episode.
Yeah. So we're moving along quickly here because I want to get to a bit more of the meat. And I think this is our first big, really unsettling sort of disjointed scene from Mary, our main character.
Yeah. She goes to date, like what we've seen is basically she is seeing this corpse periodically.
In mirrors and reflections.
In unexpected places. Yeah. So.
And no one else can see it. At one point she talks to the landlady about it and the landlady's like, there's nobody here.
Yes, you know? Exactly. So, yeah.
She goes to a department store. She's going to buy some clothes for her new job. She goes into the dressing room, and she again goes into this fugue state. In this point, I don't think she sees the corpse, but what happens to her, Andy, when she leaves the dressing room?
So when she leaves the dressing room, she finds that nobody else in the store is acting like they can perceive her.
And everything's quiet.
Yes.
Like silence. And I don't just mean nobody's talking. I mean, all incidental sound and everything has been canceled. And it's like she can't hear, but it's more than that. It's like everyone is ignoring her. And I put in my notes here, it seems like she's a ghost. And this is where I started to suspect where this movie is going.
Exactly.
I don't know when you started to suspect it, but it's right here for me.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, in our modern day, we've seen a couple too many movies with this as a plot element for this to really be a shock. But
it's like the OG.
As soon as the scene hits, I was like, oh, she's a ghost. Or, you know,
right.
She is separated because she's trying to interact with the shopkeeper, with some of the other people in the store, and they're just carrying on their business like she's not there. So.
Yeah, and this is, I immediately had Sixth Sense vibes, right? I'm like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. She even seems to check her pulse.
Did you notice this?
She puts her hand up to her neck, and it I could be reading into it, but it looked to me like she was checking her pulse.
Yes.
So, a quick aside, I'm sorry. This scene features her riding in an escalator. What decade do you guys think the escalator was invented?
Yeah. When was the escalator invented? I'm going to say 1930s.
Brad?
I'll go 1905.
Oh, you guys are way off. Although Brad's closer. The first, the escalator was invented in the 1850s.
Oh,
what powered it?
The first working one, though, wasn't installed until 1892 as a novelty ride.
When was the first death by escalator?
That's a great question. They didn't become common until the 1920s. Can I share a little bit of Andy lore?
Please.
I grew up terrified of escalators because my mom, and this would have been in the 60s when she was like a teenager, got her arm stuck in an escalator. And she had to break her arm to get it out before she was like sucked under the machinery.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Oh. So there's your horror for this episode.
That's a horror story. Well, I guess I won't tell my story about how I got lost in Michigan Stadium for 5 minutes.
Yeah. I can't touch those like rubber bands on the side of escalators because I just imagine what happened to my mom.
Oh my gosh. So. I always used to worry that I would like getting on, like I would fall over. That was my fear. Like the edges of those stairs are so sharp, I worried I was fall over and like hurt myself. But anyway,
all right. So back to the film. So yeah, I do think though that she's checking her pulse. I don't know what the significance is exactly, but yeah.
So she goes out of the department store. She starts sort of running around town. She can't hear anything. It's all unsettling. She asks people if they can see her. And the spell is broken when she looks up through some trees and she hears a bird. tweeting the bird song, and then sort of reality comes rushing back in, and she can be seen and heard, and there's a man there who really freaks her out. I don't know why. He's just kind of creepy looking.
Yeah, yeah.
But also there is a doctor, and not a psychiatrist, but a doctor, and she's sort of having a meltdown in the middle of this park. And he says, well, come back to my office. I'm a doctor. I'm like, lady, do not go to strange men's offices. But yes, this is the 1960s. Turns out he's an okay guy. But she describes her experience to him.
It was more than just not being able to hear anything or make contact with anyone. It was as though for a time I didn't exist. As though I had no place in the world. No part of the life around me.
So one thing that's interesting, John, about this is, so the experience in that department store has suggested that she might be a ghost or dead or somehow just separated from the world, as she just articulated in that quote.
Right.
But it's not, what makes this film interesting is that it's not like The Sixth Sense, right? The movie where if you like look back and you realize, oh, no one was ever interacting with him. He was always a ghost through the whole movie.
Right.
In this one, though, she is genuinely interacting with people, but she's just having these fugue states where she is then separated, and it's not consistent in a good way. Does that make sense?
It does, because the landlady definitely knows and sees her. Johnny wants to take her on a date.
Yeah, and the doctor is talking to her.
Yeah, absolutely. They do set up here one bit, though, is at one point he turns the back of his chair to her to write some stuff down. He makes a particular point of pointing that out, and that's going to pay off later when she goes to see him again.
Oh, so, absolutely. Hey, and one more quick history quiz, guys. So
yeah.
She is freaked out by a guy at a water fountain. What decade do you guys think the water fountain was invented?
I'm going to say 1910s.
Brad?
1780.
Okay. So
Brad's on to you, Andy.
So they've been around since like ancient Egypt, some form of water fountain, but the form we know now was invented in the 19-teens. So I'm going to give that one to John as a method of improving public health.
Right. Yes. So right. The other thing I'd like to bring here is when I said the movie was flat, now we start to get some, when she hallucinates, the world gains depths in visually. For her, you know, there's more shadows, there's more contrast. One thing I left out is she did go to the pavilion earlier with the priest after the first incident in the church.
Yes.
But now she's decided to go back alone.
Can I cut in here?
Yeah.
One of the things the doctor suggested was that the figure she has been hallucinating, this corpse guy, might represent guilt. He doesn't go into it, and the movie doesn't either, but that lingered in my mind.
Right. And a couple of times people have asked her about her accident. You know, are you sure you're okay driving all the way to Utah? The accident was only a week ago. It's stuff like that. And that's often brought up in the movie. But she decides to go back to what I'll call the pavilion, but it's the creepy giant structure on the edge of the Great Salt Lake. But before we get there, she does have one line she says to the doctor. He talks to her about imagination at playing tricks, and she just says, I have no desire for the close company of other people.
Mm.
And the only reason I didn't pull that clip is we've got so many clips.
Yeah.
I didn't want the whole thing to be clips, which is interesting because the movie, again, features a lot of silence. We're about to get a big, long, silent sequence here, but it's the next big sequence here is she goes to the pavilion and she goes around and explores it. And it's like a fun house and a dance floor and all this stuff going on. And I got the sense here that she liked it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like that it was really creepy, but like creepy things happen, like a ride moves without her, without anybody being there. Or
yes,
there's this thing, this slide where you slide these mattresses down.
She's not scared away by those spooky occurrences.
No.
It's more like she's intrigued and feels drawn further in by them.
Yes, exactly. She's not terrified of this place. She sort of has this weird satisfied look on her face, like this, like contentment almost.
Yes.
And she has another vision of the man. This time he is just underwater, same suit, same tie, same makeup, but just under the surface of the water. Is there anything else you want to say about this scene, because I think it's important?
I just wanted to say, so I'm sure this is not the first movie to do it, but there is something, my son would call this a liminal space, like the abandoned amusement yes. park, basically. There's something.
Yeah, I was just waiting for the Joker to show up. At
yeah,
some
there's something just genuinely profound and alluring, I think, about an abandoned space like this, where
yes.
that where once it was literally a center of human interaction and human joy, and now it is dead and rusting. I think we all feel that, right? It's why these things show up in movies all the time. But
and why there's a whole genre of YouTube movies where people break into
exactly
old buildings they're not supposed to.
I don't know when the first, you know, film was that investigated an abandoned place, but this sequence captures that experience very well.
Yeah. So things start to accelerate for Mary. She seems to be losing her mind. So she goes back to the church to practice. I think she has an interaction with Johnny here, but I'm gonna.
Yeah, he's been creeping on her like periodically yeah. throughout here. He's just pressuring her to go out with him, basically.
Right, and so she goes to the church to practice, like she does in the evenings. But she says to Johnny, like she find like after the conversation with the doctor, she finally says, "Okay, I'm gonna go practice at the church. Pick me up after, okay." So she goes and she starts playing, and then she has another one of these fugues. She is playing, her hands are moving, there's no sound, there's no organ music, it's again silent, and she has another vision of this man, but then also a woman too, coming out of the water. Now we're seeing multiple zombies.
Yes, this is our first additional, like we have a second corpse here for the first time.
Yes, and then she has a vision of the carnival, of the pavilion, and what she sees, and this was really effective to me. She sees like these undead couples in formal wear, all in black, dancing on this dance floor in the pavilion that she had walked across previously.
Yes.
And as she watches, they dance faster and faster, and it's not egregious, but like there's this pace, and then the man breaks off and sort of lunges towards her, and it's all set to this bizarre, dissonant organ music. And as he lunges for her, a hand comes down on her hands on the organ keyboard, and it's the priest. And he's like, "What are you doing?" And this is what he says.
"Profane, sacrilege, what are you playing in this church? Have you no respect? Do you feel no reverence? And I feel sorry for you and your lack of soul. This organ, the music of this church, these things have meaning and significance to us. I assume they did to you. But without this awareness, I'm afraid you cannot be our organist. In conscience, I must ask you to resign."
Yeah, and so I love that you got a bit of that organ music in there, Brad, because that's yes. trying to describe it doesn't do it justice. And second, she doesn't say anything. She just gets up and leaves. How did this resonate with you, Andy?
This so I mean, this scene landed less like, "Oh, what a huge jerk the priest is," and more like she is losing this last connection she has with what it means to be a living human.
Yes. And she, again, we get the sign of her not having a soul.
Yes. Right?
And so what so the next thing is a desperate act on her part. She goes on a date with Johnny to form some yes. kind of human connection. So they go to like a bar, you know, there's people dancing and there's like, you know, it sounds like big band music, and she's absolutely miserable. And Johnny is actually miserable. And she just sits there and she keeps saying, "No, I want to be with you. I want to hang out with you." But she clearly does not.
Yeah.
And this is where my heart is sort of reaching out to her at this moment. I'm like, she is so desperate for any kind of connection. She isn't actually, what she's realized is she needs some sort of close connection to ground yes. her. She doesn't know how to do it. She doesn't want it, but yeah. she's going to try to do it with Johnny because he's there, right?
Yes.
And she ends up drinking a little bit and saying, "Hey, let's go home. Maybe we can, get together. And she clearly isn't interested. Johnny's just a lech who will take any opportunity he can find.
Yeah.
So they go home. There's chatter about, you know, we can't let the landlady hear and everything. She lets Johnny into her room. He starts rubbing her shoulders and kissing the back of her neck. And she looks in the mirror. And what does she see, Andy?
She sees the corpse.
Yes. She sees the corpse man. It's not Johnny kissing her neck. It's the corpse man. And she screams. She turns around and it's Johnny there. And he's sort of flabbergasted. Even Johnny, who would sleep with anything with a heartbeat, is had enough of her. And here's what he says.
Hey, what's the matter with you? What's going on around here? What's the matter with you?
That man's after me. You gotta stop him. He's after me again.
I'm getting out.
No, you have to go.
Not me, sister. That's just what I need. Get mixed up with some girl who's off her rocker.
I don't want to be left alone.
Oh, like chills. Like that's just,
yeah. And then she starts fervently going around her room and like blocking the doors and the window as if to keep this man away. And there's this amazing shot where you see her in silhouette through the curtains from the outside now. And she's running around the room doing crazy stuff. And then the shot keeps getting further and further and further away. It's kind of great. But then we cut to the morning.
Yeah.
And the landlady has called the doctor. No, the doctor has come to check on her. And he's coming back downstairs. So we don't have a scene where the doctor's there, but the doctor comes down to give exposition to the landlady. And she's determined to leave. She's going to get out of this town. And I think it's the doctor who says she'll leave if she can. You know, yes. It's this sort of ominous statement.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, when was like the last time, do you think, that a doctor like came to your house?
Just to follow up?
To follow up, or because he had a hunch about something?
Yeah, only in the movies probably ever, but
I know some people in Europe who like where it's not unusual to, you know, go to a doctor's house to get your checkup or something like that. But like just here in America, it feels like a very long time ago.
So she's determined to leave. She packs her suitcase, she puts it in her Chevy Impala, and she walks out like some kind of robot. But then so a lot of things happen here. Her car starts to break down. So she goes to a mechanic, and the mechanic lets her sit in the car while it's on the lift.
Yeah, do you think they'd still let you do this if you asked?
But she sees the man there again, right?
Yeah.
So she flees, and she goes to a bus stop. Now, she's clearly having another one of these fugues where she can't hear.
She flees on foot.
She flees on foot. Thank you.
Yeah. And she's running through a busy city, right?
And nobody can see her. Nobody can interact with her, and she tries to get on a bus. This is one of the great creepy scenes in this movie.
Yes.
So she hears, she can't hear anything. No one will interact with her. The guy behind the guy in the ticket window won't sell her a ticket. He ignores her. But then she hears this robotic radio creepy voice over the speaker say, bus number nine is leaving. She runs out to bus number nine. She throws open the door and climbs on, and who's there?
She sees a bus full of corpses.
Yes, it's the people who are dancing at the pavilion in her earlier hallucination.
Yes.
She flees, and then we pick up this sound, which is amazing, which is there's no sound but her shoes echoing, and they keep getting louder and louder. She sees a policeman. She can't get anything to happen, but then she has the same interaction. She sees through the sunlight, she hears a bird tweeting, and the world comes back.
Yes.
And she realizes she's near the doctor's office, so she goes there to talk to him, and she's talking to him, and he is facing away from her with the back of his chair facing her, and this is what she says to him.
I came to you, doctor, because you're my last hope. If you don't help me, I have to go back there. He's trying to take me back somewhere. Doctor, you've got to tell me what to do.
But what happens is the doctor turns around and it is the corpse again.
Yes.
And she flees again. she then gets back in her car. So she wakes up from this fugue in her car. All of that was some sort of dream state or something. But she drives back to the pavilion because she sort of realized there's no place else for her to go. And the zombies are dancing. And then she, in some of the shots, looks like a zombie who's dancing.
Yeah.
But here's the part that may interest the zombie fans. As she's there, they all see her and they all start to run after her as if they are some sort of horde. And they play this sort of cat and mouse seeking game. Do you want to describe some of this, Andy? Because it's kind of delightful.
Well, it's just really artfully shot. She's hiding around corners and trying to take refuge. And it's not really working.
Yeah. So she runs out on the beach and they're all chasing her on the beach as the sun is coming up. And then she collapses on the beach and we cut away. And it's the next morning and a police car drives up. And in the police car are the doctor, the pastor, a policeman, and some handyman or something. I don't know who this fourth person is. They look at her footprints. What's different about her footprints than what we expect to see? They're just hers.
Yes.
And there's a spot where she lands and we zoom in on a handprint. Well, the policeman gives us this narrative.
The car's still over there, and then the footprints leading up to here. And then nothing.
But that's not the end. So we then cut back to the river from the beginning of the film that they were dredging. They say, we found it, and there's a tow truck, and they pull the car from the beginning with the three girls in it out of the water. And who's in the car, Andy?
Mary is in the car.
She's been dead the whole time! I make fun of that, and I make a joke, but
It's so good.
And Brad, you captured some of the organ music in this transition. Could you just play a little? Because it's so good. Not even sure that's just an organ. If there's like a, yeah, it's like a glass harp or something.
There's
like,
something I don't else know going to, on there
yeah.
too. Yeah,
the composer was trying to make organ music like an orchestra.
Okay,
so he would try and make it sound fuller. I think it is all organ.
Oh wow! All right, well it's amazing. We realize Mary has been dead this whole time, and then we cut to the end of the movie. So amazing! I loved this movie. And I feel comfortable spoiling it. I want to get your thoughts. Yeah. But I think the big one for me is this movie is still great without the twist.
Agreed. I mean, this is a theme that has been riffed on in stories and movies and Twilight Zone episodes and everything since.
Yes.
So you will realize, you know, probably 25 minutes in that, okay, she's dead, you know.
Yeah.
And you may have been wondering this since like 10 minutes into the film, honestly.
Right.
But that's not, the story doesn't rely on that being a surprise. It just, because the thrill of the story is her own creeping realization of what her situation is.
Right. And I think actually The Sixth Sense is a brilliant movie and will be remembered as a classic. But if there's something missing out from it, it is Bruce Willis's character not going through that experience. You know what I mean? He does in a way, but he's sort of more clueless than Mary. And I think Mary sort of realizes something is happening to her.
Yes, exactly.
And there's a certain acceptance of her fate at the end that causes her to go back to the pavilion.
Yes.
So I mean... I want to go through the questions, but anything else you want to say before we get there? I just thought this movie, it was the word I'll use is trippy. Like,
yes,
it was the first movie that was deeply unsettling. And now I think there's, I don't want to say there's lots of movies like this, but this just isn't a genre or a type or a vibe of movie that we have seen yet. And I don't know if these exist elsewhere, but it's very singular so far for us.
Yeah. This movie sets itself apart from the B movies we've been watching in like the first 90 seconds. Like
yes.
you will just You will see camera angles. You will see shots that feel like this is a modern movie and not one of these older movies we've been watching. And I am sure, as we've discussed on this podcast before, you know, we are limited to talking about the zombie movies of each era here,
yes,
which are generally going to be the B movies. They're generally going to be lagging behind the filmmaking developments and the thematic developments that are happening in other better films. But this was a movie that was startling to watch.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I am not an expert on the history of Hollywood and the studio system, but what you have is some great people like Jacques Turner turning out really sort of subversive, amazing things like I Walked with a Zombie and Cat People within the studio system. But a lot of the horror stuff is just being knocked out to entertain teens on a Saturday night. So there's not a lot of directorial intent or voice. And I think what we're seeing here is a director who has no master and is saying, I want to make a movie in a way that I want to make it, and I don't care if the studio bosses like it or not.
Exactly. Yeah. This felt like someone making a student film or something like that.
Yes.
Like, in the sense that it's not really beholden to a need to make a profit or a need to, you know, to talk to a certain market or anything like that. It's just somebody's vision, right?
And I'd also like to point out, like, I don't want to make too general a proclamation, but this is our first movie where, like, the heroine does not survive.
And interesting.
And that is a shift in narrative from what we've been doing. And I think the 60s, that's going to accelerate, right?
Yeah.
You can't have a zombie movie, like a hardcore zombie movie, without some of our heroes not making it, or without people, without, in some cases, nobody making it.
Yeah.
Right? That's part of the narrative. And we haven't quite seen that yet. You know what I mean? There is Revenge of the Zombies where the zombie kills the doctor, but the doctor's not really our hero. He's a villain. She's our hero, and she doesn't make it. And that's, I think, singular again so far.
It is interesting. I mean, we'll get into this with our wrap up questions, but you know, it's. I need to watch some of the feminist film of this era because this felt like a feminist film to me. It was this woman navigating in 1962. Women in America were in a weird place, right?
Yeah.
They had this season of liberation, of empowerment, but then throughout the 50s, they were being shoved back into the box.
Yeah.
And this is a story of a woman navigating a man's world, right? The people she interacts with are mostly men.
Yep.
There's this fundamental disconnection to that masculine world. I don't know. I need to watch more.
All right. So let's do the questions. I'm ready.
Yeah. All right. So let's fly through these, John. Carnival of Souls, is there a hero party?
I'd say no. We've just got Mary.
Yeah. I'm going to skip through a few of these that aren't as relevant.
Uh-huh.
What kind of zombie are we dealing with in this movie, John?
Okay. So first tough question. Are we dealing with a zombie? Just because it made it into our radar doesn't mean that's the case. Are these not ghosts?
This is a film that sneaked onto the list of zombie films through a technicality, I think, not like a thematic.
Well, but yeah, I mean, they look like zombies, right? I mean, if we can take one zombie thing away from this movie, it's that we do get a horde of people chasing a single person. It feels like a modern zombie movie in that sense.
It does.
But I don't think they physically exist in the world.
The
movie is too sort of vague to make that distinction, but nobody else sees them. They don't attack anybody else.
Agreed.
She doesn't even exist.
Our questions are geared for literal zombies, and they don't map as well to more abstract zombies like this movie has.
Yeah.
You know, these zombies are like what? They're like reflections of mortality. They're kind of spiritual reminders or guiding posts to like help her understand the nature of where she is. So these are zombies as sort of like a supernatural, like, messenger almost, I feel.
Yeah, and even though I'm saying they might not be zombies, just to be clear, they are fast zombies. They're fast maybe zombies.
And they we do get the rare fast zombie. And we do get a horde of fast zombies chasing someone in this movie, which is funny because this is not really a traditional zombie movie in any way, shape, or form.
It's all creep and atmosphere until the zombies start sprinting after her.
So drilling down, though, on the zombie part.
Yeah.
Are there any zombie firsts that we see here that maybe were picked up by later zombie films, maybe made a little bit more less abstract and more literal and used?
I think this horde of zombies feels like zombies from Night of the Living Dead. Very specifically, it's people dressed in clothes that look horrific, that are clearly sinister, chasing you around. And I don't know, even though we've had some hordes and stuff, I don't know if we've seen it quite like this before.
I think that you're right. I am also going to posit that just the environment of the abandoned amusement park,
yes,
it feels like it belongs to the zombie genre.
Yeah, you're about to ask me if there's an apocalypse, and I was going to say no, but the abandonment of the amusement park has that apocalypse vibe.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, hey, let's jump into those pillars.
One statement. All the other zombies we have seen have a clear source, right?
Yeah. I have no idea where these folks are.
These just sort of show up.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's no origin for them.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, yeah, I think one thing zombies do, movies do all the time, all the way back to White Zombie, is there's some explanation for how they came about. There's nothing here.
That's a good point. Yep.
Yeah, it's a good point.
All right, so let's get into your four pillars of the zombie genre, John. We already talked about this. Is there an apocalypse in this movie?
Okay, so I'm going to say yes, because the abandoned pavilion creates the vibe. There is spiritually an apocalypse here, even though there's not a world apocalypse. You gonna let me get by with that?
I think so. I'll give it a pass. Yeah.
All right.
Is there contagion in this movie?
No, I don't think so. I think they're after her, but I don't know that she becomes, well, she does become one of them sort of at the end. I don't know. Now I'm doubting myself.
I mean, this is, when we say they're after her, I mean, I feel like it's at least partly her own mind trying to talk to her through these images, right?
Yes. But there is a moment where she is one of the zombies dancing near the end of the film before they break into a chase with her.
Okay.
So I like this movie. It's unclear. How about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good. And are there tough moral choices in this movie?
Not in the spirit of the question that we originally, which is, do you have to make choices, survivor style choices about what to do during the zombie apocalypse?
Yeah, I'd agree. And lastly, does this movie feature loved ones turning against you?
I'm again saying no, because if the zombies had been the other women in the car or something, I would say yes. But
so I did
not.
Wonder. When she first sees her second zombie, who isn't just that creepy guy, it's a woman.
Yes.
Was that woman one of the girls who was in the car with her?
And I meant to go back actually and check, but I'm not sure.
I don't think so,
but it's a possibility. Yeah. So again, unclear.
I believe no, looking at the IMDb credits, that I don't think so.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so I'd say, but again, that's what this movie is about, being the sort of ephemeral, or the, not ephemeral is not the right word, this unclear, this ambiguous state she's in. Is she alive? Is she dead? Are these people, you know? And so I think these questions are hard to answer. But what about you? Is paranoia a major theme in this movie?
Well, so I got into this a little bit early when I was talking about this being feeling like a feminist film.
Yeah.
This does feel like a more thematically poignant film than the ones we've seen to date.
Yes. But she's paranoid.
She is paranoid because she sees something that nobody else around her sees. Like and she can't even talk or explain these things to the world, to the real world around her, because they either don't hear her at all, or else hearing her, they dismiss it as just nothing. Right.
Right.
And yeah, that feels in line with the themes of like kind of paranoia. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I think you're right. I think there's a sense of this zombie stalking her, like it could be the communist in your backyard kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's a,
yeah,
it, you know, so I think there's paranoia. It feels very paranoiac to me. How have our movie heroes changed? Are they younger, less professional?
Yes, I do think I do get that sense from this movie. She's a young woman. She's single. She's not engaged. She doesn't have a boyfriend. She's not married. She's not beholden to the men in her life exactly. But she is a young woman in a man's world, right?
Right.
Her boss is this priest who is, you know, he's nice enough to her as long as she plays her part.
Right.
Her neighbor is this creepy lech, right? Who is over this really overwhelmingly unpleasant and pushy person that she struggles to just, I mean, she struggles to just keep him out of her room, right?
Right.
It's a man's world that she's in. And I don't know, this feels like it's talking a little bit about the experience of being like a middle-class woman and young woman in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you, does science and sci-fi take on a new role here? I don't think there's anything.
No, I don't think so.
He did invoke Jean Cocteau when he talked about his style, and that would tell me there's no scientific explanations is coming up here. Yeah,
there's really nothing that's plot important that's science related here.
And the last one is, does the genre leave its local roots and move on to the broader American stage?
Well, in the sense that the genre, this is, I mean, I'll spoil the answer to a question we're going to ask in a minute. This is not a zombie movie, right? However, it's using imagery that is very closely associated with zombie films.
And I think that's super important because from a technical isn't even the right word, but when we have our sort of, you know, sort of etymology of like movie monsters, right? Or how we analyze the movie monster species, like maybe these aren't zombies, but for a filmmaker's eye, for how zombies look and behave, like I feel that is definitely here.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I think an important part of a monster becoming iconic is that it becomes a sort of shorthand for ideas and feelings and experiences. And I think you could argue that the appearance of things that sure look like zombies brings with it a host of baggage that viewers will unpack instinctively.
And they are terrifying when they rush at her as a horde.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. All right, John, let's ask the last couple of questions here. John, would you and I survive in the zombie world of Carnival of Souls?
Well, I mean, no, because if we were in this world, we'd be dead already. We just wouldn't know it yet.
Yes, exactly.
Well, do you guys drag race often?
No, I mean, just once in a while. No,
I don't. We don't. But I mean, so it isn't Mary who drag races. Like,
no, it's her friend. Mary's clearly unsettled by this choice.
And we've all been in the car with somebody with much less common sense than us, right?
Brad, you and I have been in a car together with that person. We were driving down a dirt road once, and our friend Chris was swerving back and forth in his four-wheel drive. Ended up doing
he was showing us how his four-wheel drive worked in the snow.
He worked in the snow. That's... Ended up doing a 180 into a tree. We were all fine. But so Beth and I have been there now that you mention it.
Has this Chris learned? Did he learn the right lessons from that experience?
I hope so.
Okay. All right.
I hope so. I didn't really see him after high school. I have no idea.
I'm not aware of any other accidents in his life.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, John, is this a zombie movie or is this a movie with zombies?
It's a movie with ghosts. It's not a zombie movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's a movie with zombies either.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a movie playing. I mean, this tells me
it
that
it plays a role in the filmmaking of zombies.
Yes,
for sure. So I'll say movie with zombies because I think even if, like, from a technical definition, I think they're ghosts. They play the role of zombies visually.
Yeah,
you know? I think to her they are zombies.
Yes, yeah.
But her reality isn't reality.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, I'll buy that. I like that.
I'll say that we have not seen very many zombie movies doing anything like really out there with the premise.
No.
So I don't think anyone involved in this movie was like, hey, we're making a zombie movie. Let's put some zombies in here. But they obviously are drawing on zombie imagery, and they are doing something, I would say, artistic and interesting and offbeat with it. And this is my way of saying this is a movie that happens to have some zombie-like things in it. I hope, though, that it's going to encourage future zombie filmmakers to realize, like, hey, we don't have to tell the same two or three zombie stories over and over again. We could use zombies in like a weird way in a different type of movie that leverages some of their fear and terror, but does something different from it than like, hey, there's like four white people at a plantation in Haiti that are getting into trouble again. Right.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I guess time will tell if that actually happens. So lastly, John, do you recommend this movie, firstly, as a general movie that everyone should go watch? And secondly, should our legion of zombie-loving freaks that are listening to this podcast watch this to learn something new about the zombie genre?
So as far as everyone watching it, yes, everyone should watch it. This would be a great Halloween movie to watch. It's spooky. It's got tons of atmosphere. It feels unique and fresh. I enjoyed every minute of it. Would I recommend it to zombie-loving fans? I'm going to go say no. I'm going to say no because I don't think there's enough zombie action. Like, I think there's some visual cues that get picked up later. I don't know. I'm still going to say no.
I totally agree. So, yeah.
But since everyone should watch it anyway, they should watch it too. How about
exactly.
That?
Yeah, we've never really parsed out that little paradox of our choices there. But
yes.
When this episode first airs, it's going to be Halloween-ish. Man, this is a perfect Halloween movie. You have not seen this movie, I don't think, and you should. So go watch it. It's also something you can watch with your whole family if you want to watch something that's like genuinely a little creepy, but is, it's not, just doesn't have gore, doesn't have any of that sort of stuff. Definitely, this is a great movie. Zombie fans, no, I don't think you need to go out of your way to watch this. Except if you're a good person that likes good films, you will watch it because it's a good film.
There you go.
All right, so it's time for the scariest part of the episode, and that is when Brad reveals to us what we will be watching next. And I have to assume we've had a good run to date. We had Santo, we had Roger Corman, we had this masterpiece. I feel like we're karmically due for like a real dip in quality. So, Brad, give it to us.
Let us have it.
Well, how about if we go back to Mexico?
Yes. All right.
Oh,
okay.
I'll go back to Mexico.
Here is the poster for our next movie.
Okay. La Cabeza Viviente.
The Living Head. Is that what
the
it is?
The Living Head. Wow.
All right, so what we have on this poster is, the most prominent feature is a decapitated head, including blood splatter here, which might make this maybe the most gruesome poster we've seen to date.
So far, and he's dressed up in some sort of Aztec or Mayan headdress.
Yeah. He has a look of like kind of pleasant relaxation on his face, but he is a decapitated head. And in the top left is a scantily clad woman wielding a dagger.
Yep.
And in the bottom right is a scary looking person dressed up like sort of your stereotypical Aztec warrior sort of person.
Okay. And I'd like to point out the scantily, maybe you didn't notice it because it's a scantily clad woman. Her knife is made out of obsidian. It's like black.
Okay.
Rock. It's
That's not
like
where my eyes went on that illustration of the woman, but very good. Good for you, John.
I don't know if you can tell, but in the bottom corner, left corner, the name of the director is there. Can you read it?
Cheno Uritra?
He directed The Revived Monster.
Oh.
All right. Okay. Well, now I'm excited.
What is this? So in the tradition of The Revived Monster, which was, I think, Il Monstro Resuscitado, what is the like most mundane English interpretation that we could get out of this, out of La Cabeza Viviente?
I don't know.
I don't know. I guess I maybe just the living head, but like it just doesn't have the ring to it, does it?
All right, everybody. Well, while we're here, please subscribe in your podcast app of choice. Rate us. It really helps people find the show. We also have other podcasts. My podcast is called Splatbook, and it features me, my friend Ben, and my friend Jess talking about RPG games and experiences. What do you do in your non-Zombie Strange time, Andy?
Yeah, my non-Zombie Strange podcast is Roll for Topic. It's also is a podcast about tabletop role-playing games, specifically about how to run tabletop role-playing games. So yeah, go check it out.
And of course, Brad has another podcast.
Multiplex Overthruster, Movies of the 80s.
That's right. So please check those out, and please join us next week for another episode where we talk about El Cabeza Viviente. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend. Follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.